Good morning, everyone. These lines we just heard Mother read with Sunil Das' moving music come at the end of Canto 7 of Book 2, The Descent into Night. That's the book we are reading at the moment, and we have reached page 211 at the break. We have yet to read the next two sections, so that's what we'll do now. We'll read to the end of the canto, and then we'll go back and look in more detail from this point on page 211, line 335. Anmol, you'd like to start?
A greater darkness waited, a worse rain. Worse can be where all is evil's extreme. Yet to the cloaked, the uncloaked is naked worst. There, God and truth and the supernal light had never been, or else had power no more. As when one slips in a deep moment's trance over mind's border into another world, he crossed a boundary whose stealthy trace I could not see, but only the soul feel. Into an armored, fierce domain he came and saw himself wandering like a lost soul amid grimed walls and savage slums of night. Around him, crowded, gray and squalid huts, neighboring proud palaces of perverted power, inhuman quarters and demoniac wards. A pride in evil hugged its wretchedness, a misery haunting splendor pressed those fell, dun suburbs of the cities of dreamland. Their life displayed to the spectator soul the shadowed depths of her strange miracle, a strong and fallen goddess without hope, obscured, deformed by some dire Gorgon spell, as might a harlot empress in a bouge, nude, unashamed, exulting she appraised her evil face of perilous beauty and charm, and drawing panic to a shuddering kiss, twixt the magnificence of her fatal breasts, allured to their abyss, the spirit's fall. Across his field of sight, she multiplied, as on a scenic film or moving plate, the implacable splendor of her nightmare forms. On the dark background of a soulless world, she staged between a lurid light and shade her dramas of the sorrow of the depths, written on the agonized nerves of living things, epics of horror and grim majesty, dry statues spat and stiffened in life's mud, a glut of hideous forms and hideous deeds, paralyzed pity in the hardened breast.
Thank you, Paula.
In booths of sin and night repairs of vice, styled infamies of the body's concupiscence, and sordid imaginations etched in flesh, turned lust into a decorative art, abusing nature's gift, her pervert skill, immortalized the sown grain of living death. In a mud goblet poured the Bacchic wine, to a satyr gave the theories
Thyrsus
of a god. Impure, sadistic, grimacing mouths, gray, foul inventions, gruesome and macabre, came televisioned from the gulfs of night. Her craft ingenious in monstrosity, impatient of all natural shape and poise, a gape of nude, exaggerated lines gave caricature a stark reality, and art parades of weird, distorted forms and gargoyle masks obscene and terrible trampled to tormented postures the torn sense. An inexorable Eve, she made violence great and sublimated filth, a dragon power of reptile energies and strange epiphanies of groveling force and serpent grandeurs couching in the mire, drew adoration to a gleam of slime. All nature pulled out of her frame and base was twisted into an unnatural pose. Pulsion stimulated inert desire. Agony was made a red spiced food for bliss. Hatred was trusted with the work of lust, and torture took the form of an embrace, a ritual anguish consecrated death, worship was offered to the undivine.
Thank you, Brian.
A new thesis of Inferno's art that trained the mind to love what the soul hates, imposed allegiance on the quivering nerves, and forced the unwilling body to vibrate. Too sweet and too harmonious to excite. In this regime that soiled the being's core, beauty was banned, the heart's feeling dulled to sleep, and cherished in their place, sensations thrilled. The world was probed for jets of sense appeal. Here cold material, intellect was the judge, and needed sensual prick and jog and lash, that its hard dryness and dead nerves might feel some passion and power and acrid point of life. A new philosophy theorized evil's rights, gloried in the shimmering rot of decadence, or gave to a python force persuasive speech, and armed with knowledge the primeval brute. Over life and matter only brooding bowed, mind changed to the image of a rampant beast. It scrambled into the pit to dig for truth, and lighted its search with subconscious flares. Thence bubbling rose, sullying the upper air, the filth and festering secrets of the abyss, this it called positive fact of real life. This now composed the fetid atmosphere. A wild beast passion crept from secret night to watch its prey with fascinating eyes. Around him, like a fire with sputtering tongues, there lolled and laughed at bestial ecstasy. The air was packed with longings, brute and fierce, crowding and stinging in a monstrous swarm, pressed with a noxious hum into his mind. Thoughts that could poison nature's heavenliest breath, forcing reluctant lids, assailed the sight. Acts that reveal the mystery of hell, all that was there was on this pattern made.
Thank you.
The race possessed in inhabited those a force demoniac lurking in man's depths that he suppressed by the heart's human law, awed by the calm and sovereign eyes of God, and in the fire and earthquake of the soul, arise and, calling to its naked mind, overthrow the reason, occupy the land, and stamp its hoof on nature's shaking ground. This was for them their being's flaming core, a mighty energy, a monster god, hard to the strong, implacable to the weak. It stared at the harsh, unpitying world to make, with the stony islands of its fixed eye. Its heart was drunk with a dire, hungerous wine. In others suffering felt a great delight, and of death and ruin the grandiose music heard. To have power was so virtuous and good. It claimed the whole world for evil's living room. Its parties grim, totalitarian reign, the cruel destiny of breathing things. All of land was shaped and standardized under a dark dictatorship's breathless weight. In street and house, in councils and in courts, beings he met who looked like living men and climbed in speech upon high wings of thought, but harbored all that is subhuman, vile, and lower than the lowest reptiles.
Just one more sentence.
The reason meant for nearness to the gods, and uplift the heavenly scale by the touch of man, when he enhanced by its enlightening breath in their inborn nature's rough monstrosity.
Thank you, Don.
Often a familiar visage, studying joyfully, encountered ever dangerous turn, hoping to recognize a look of light. His vision, worn by the spirit's inward eye, discovered suddenly hell's trademark, or saw with the inner sense the air in the semblance of a fair or viral form.
Virile.
Or zero form, the demon and the goblin and the ghoul. The insolence reigned of cold, stone-hearted strength, mighty, obeyed, proved by the titans in law, the huge laughter of a giant cruelty, and fierce, glad deeds of ogre violence. In that wide, cynic den of thinking beasts, one looked in vain for a trace of pity or love. There was no touch of sweetness anywhere, but only force and its acolytes, greed and hate. There was no help for suffering, none to save. None dared resist or speak a noble word. Armed with the aegis of tyrannic power, signing the edicts of her dreadful rule, and using blood and torture as a seal, darkness proclaimed her slogans to the world.
Thank you. Marianne, Connaught Reid, Lupa.
Servile.
Servile, liberal signs, harsh the mind, or only repeated lessons taught. While mitred, holding the good shepherd's staff, falsehood enthroned on old and prostrate hearts, and weeds that organize living death and slay the soul on the altar of a lie. All were deceived or served their own deceit. Truth at that tightening atmosphere could not bear wretchedness believed in its own joy. A fear and weakness hugged their abject death. All that is low and sordid, sordid, beast, drab and poor and miserable, breathed in a lax content its natural air and felt no yearning of divine release. Arrogant,
jibing
at more luminous states, the people of the Gulf despised the sun, a buried autarky, excluded light, fixed in its will to be its own grey self. It wanted its known unique and splendid type. It soothed its hunger with a plunderer's dream, flaunting its cross of servitude like a crown. It clung to its dismal, harsh atonement, a bow-trod bellowed with its brazen tongue, its hard and shameless clamor filling space and threatening all who dared to listen to truth, claimed the monopoly of the battered ear. A deafened acquiescence gave its word, and dragged dogmas shouted in the night, kept for the fallen soul once deemed a god the pride of its abysmal absence.
Thank you. Fanny.
A lone discoverer in these menacing waves guarded like termite cities from the sun, oppressed mid crowd and tramp and noises there, passing from dusk to deeper dangerous dusk. He wrestled with powers that snatched from mind its light and smote from him their clinging influence. Soon he emerged in a dim, warless space, for now the people tracks were left behind. He walked between wide banks of fading eve. Around him grew a gum filled with blank, a threatening waste, a sinister loneliness that left mind bare to announce in a soul, an empty page on which all that wind could write stark monstrous messages without control, a traveling dot on downward roads of dust, mid barren fields and barns and struggling huts, and a few crooked and phantasmal trees, he faced a sense of death and conscious void.
Thank you. You like to read, Prasad?
But still, the hostile life unseen was there, whose death-like poise, resisting light and truth, made living a bleak gap in nullity. He heard the grisly voice that denied, assailed by thoughts that swarmed like a spectral force, a prey to the straining phantoms of the gloom, and terror approaching with its lethal mouth. Driven by strange will, down, ever down, the sky above, communicate of doom. He strove to shield his spirit from despair, but felt the horror of the growing night and the abyss rising to claim his soul. Then ceased the abodes of the creatures and their forms, and solitude wrapped him in its voiceless folds. All vanished suddenly like a thought expunged. His spirit became an empty listening gulf, void of the dead illusions of the world. Nothing was left, not even an evil face. He was alone with the great python night.
Thank you. We'll stop. You let me read now. A dense and nameless nothing, conscious, mute, which seemed alive but without body or mind, lusted all beings to annihilate, that it might be forever nude and soul. As in a shapeless beast's intangible jaws, gripped, strangled by that lusting, viscous blot, attracted to some black and giant mouth and swallowing throat and a huge belly of doom, his being from its own vision disappeared, drawn towards depths that hungered for its fall. A formless void oppressed his struggling brain. A darkness grim and cold benumbed his flesh. A whispered gray suggestion chilled his heart. Hailed by a serpent force from its warm home and dragged to extinction in blank vacancy, life clung to its seat with cords of gasping breath. Lapped was his body by a tenebrous tongue. Existence smothered, travailed to survive. Hope strangled, perished in his empty soul. Belief and memory abolished, died, and all that helps the spirit in its course. Betty.
There crawled through every tense and achy nerve, leaving behind its poignant, quaking trail, a nameless and unutterable fear, as a sea nears a victim bound and still. The approach alarmed his mind forever dumb, of an implacable eternity, of pain inhuman and intolerable. This he must bear, his hope of heaven estranged. He must ever exist without extinction's peace, in a slow suffering time and tortured space, an anguish to nothingness, his endless state. A lifeless vacancy was now his breast, and in the place where once was luminous thought, only remained like a pale, motionless ghost, an incapacity for faith and hope, and the dread conviction of a vanquished soul, immortal still, but with its Godhead lost, self-lost, and God, and touch of happier worlds. But he endured, still the vain terror, bore the smothering coils of agony and affright. Then peace returned, and the soul's sovereign gaze. To the blank horror, a calm light replied, immutable, undying and unborn, mighty and mute, the Godhead in him woke and faced the pain and danger of the world. He mastered the ties of nature with a look. He met with his bare spirit, naked hell.
Thank you. So we'll go back to page 211 at the break. Do you like to read?
It was coming when all his feelings extreme. Yet with the blood, some blood is never lost. The God and truth and the supernal mind had never been for else like flowers as well. One says, in a deep moment's time, our minds were up into another world. Across the boundary, so it is still the past. I could not see but all the story. In the armor fears dominant camps, I saw himself wondering if it must have shown. And I beat once the savage slums of life around him, round and great,
and squalid dogs. They were in dog palaces for protect from inhuman quarters and domineering world.
Thank you. Thank you, great Paul's. So it just gets worse and worse. You think it can't get worse, but it does. We can be sure that Shobindo had these experiences. And he uses an image which has been quite often used for hell, this city of dreadful night. He comes into this city with grimed, dirty walls, savage slums of night, full of grey and squalid huts. But right next to them are these proud palaces of perverted power, inhuman quarters, and demoniac wards. A ward is an area, or a quarter of a city.
What is wards again?
Well, it's actually an area of a city that's guarded by a particular group of people. A ward, that's one ward, and then there's another one. I think you have them in America also, no? Cities are divided up into wards.
Some
yeah.
New York is divided into boroughs.
Boroughs, okay, yeah. But it's the idea of being guarded, protected, yeah?
There are political divisions in America.
Wards up. Oh, it's voting rights.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's something else, but this is the dwelling places grouped in walls.
It's a division, it's a geographic.
Yeah, right. So that's the sort of physical description. What is it like to the consciousness? Ravi, you? Yes?
I have a question. So the perspective that we're experiencing, or that he is experiencing this from, so, you know, he crossed over, I mean, there's a point of identity in
yes.
this section where he's experiencing this. And then when we come to the end of this canto, we have him saying that he has awoken, that the Godhead in him has awoken. So who's experiencing this other part of the situation here?
You could say it is his central consciousness, his central being, which is experiencing all these things on our behalf. That's what Sri Aurobindo says. This whole of book two is that he's exploring all the levels of consciousness as a representative of humanity to know what exists.
So on some kind of a personality level, like this is what an unenlightened being would experience, or non-Godhead?
I think if we go deep down into the subconscious, you can have dreams like this. No? You never had a dream like this?
Yeah.
Yeah, these are deeper levels of, we could say, the universal consciousness that we have access to. And of course, Aswapati's going there in the hope of finding out what lies at the root of all this. How can this exist? Why should this exist? What can be done to change it? That's why he's exposing himself to this terrible darkness. Find out what lies at the root of it.
What does lie at the root of it?
Ah, that comes at the end of Canto 8. I'm not going to reveal anything now.
Canto
8 is the next one. But if you want to look philosophically, you can look at that chapter in The Life Divine, which speaks about
the origin and remedy of falsehood and evil.
Exactly. Thank you, Patty. The origin and remedy of falsehood, evil, pain and suffering.
Why do you think Mother allowed illustrations on this canto, but not the next one?
Perhaps she let it go this far, and then she said, that's enough. That's what she told Huta when they came to Canto 8. She said, I've been there. I've seen it. I don't want to create images of it to enter into people's consciousness. So we've seen the images, no? I mean, the worst one is this being hailed by a serpent fall. But otherwise, she's kept them fairly positive and encouraging, focused on King Aswapati. Yes.
The line 338, they
God, truth,
and the supreme light had never been, or else had no...
Had power no more.
Had power no more.
Perhaps they'd been there once, but now they've been abolished.
So I was wondering, is the supreme light, do you think the supreme light has gone down there?
Ah, surely. Surely.
Aswapati going there is the first trip to this place.
Yes, Sri Aurobindo going into those depths, mother going into those depths. But I think that is the power, the supramental is the power that can change all this. And that's what she told us, that she saw the golden light pour and power pouring down, but it got swallowed up in all these waves of darkness. But she said, but it's there, it's at work, it's emerging. Just like we read in Canto 3 about the life power being swallowed up in matter and it being such a difficulty for life to develop, to evolve out. No? So supramental has come, it's at work, but it may be quite some time before it's emerged enough for us blind beings to recognize it clearly. We may get some hints here and there, but she says eventually even a dog or cat will notice.
Yes.
Yeah.
Even a dog or cat will
notice that something has happened, something has changed. Maybe the animals will know first. It seems to me that animal consciousness is developing in an extraordinary way. Perhaps they, like she said, the plants are so receptive. Maybe the animals also.
They have less ego. Hmm?
They have less mental resistance.
Yes, yeah. I see this line that it's quite all subjective. It's not objective. When it says yet to be cloaked, the uncloaked is naked force.
Yes.
There are different levels.
This is all subjective experience, yes.
But it looks like very much.
We can recognize that, I mentioned it before, that there are times and places in human history when these powers have expressed themselves in human societies, no? All too familiar to us.
I think it wouldn't be so shocking if we wouldn't know it.
Yeah, that's it. We recognize it as just the worst thing that we can imagine happening in our world because it's already happened. It's known. And it acts through human beings. Thank you. Shall we move on? I've got lost now. Where are we? A pride in evil, line 350 on page 211. Yes. So who's reading? Ravi is reading.
A pride in evil, hope is worship in a misery haunting splendor when those born suburb of the cities of dream light. The light is played to the spectator's soul. The shadow games of a strange miracle, a strong and potent goddess without hope, obscure, deformed by some dull, spell, as might for her loved embrace in a boon, new, unashamed, exulting.
Perilous
beauty and charm, and drawing panic to a shuddering peace, to which the magnificence of a father
gives
other to their abyss, the spirits fall.
Thank you. The beings who are there, they hug their wretchedness, they cling to it. They don't want to let go. And the characteristic of those areas, those places, is misery, haunting splendor. There's the juxtaposition of these awful slums and these proud palaces. He says these fell, dumb suburbs of the cities of dream life. Fell means dreadful, terrifying. Fell means terrifying, dreadful, fell. Somebody gives you a demon gives you a fell look. What?
Very unusual use.
Well, it's this word fell. We are not. It's an unusual word for us. No, but it is an adjective that's there in English that we don't use often. As similarly with dun. Dun means colorless, dingy, dark. Mm-hmm. Dun means dingy, dark, colorless.
Fell is terrible.
Terrible. Yeah.
Savagely and inhumanly cruel.
Yeah. Cruel. It's adjective.
That's what I said, no?
Yes.
Terrible. Don trusts his book. Trusts Rand it's better. It's okay. Thank you, Don. And we all know what suburbs are. They're the outlying parts. No, it's not the central part of the city. The suburbs around. Suburbs are often very boring places. No? Colorless, dreary.
The suburbs are much better than the city. It's like Bombay.
It depends where you are. So there, in those cities of dream life, life displayed to the spectator soul. You said, who is seeing it? It's the soul watching. And life is showing the shadow depth. He told us before that she ranges from the heights to the lowest deeps. Here she's displaying the lowest levels of her strange miracle. And she appears to him, the life goddess, this wonderful, great, winged, generous angel, gracious angel. She appears to him now as a strong but fallen goddess, without hope, obscured. Her light has been shadowed over, deformed, twisted by some dire Gorgon spell. The Gorgon is a monster in Greek literature. Her characteristic is that her look, if you see her, you're turned to stone. It is so terrible. Dire is another word, like fell, dreadful. And then in the next line, we've got this word empress used as a verb, and we've got this word bouge. I think this word was invented, not by Sri Aurobindo, but during his lifetime, by a lady called Dorothy Sayers, who translated into English verse the Divina Commedia of Dante's epic, which is in three parts. And the first part is about hell, inferno. Yeah? And he uses a word, an Italian word. Is it maybe bolge? Bolgia, yes. So she didn't know how to translate that into English, so she invented this word bouge.
But it is also a French word.
Yes?
It's a French word.
Oh, it's a French word. So what does it mean in French?
Yeah.
I think here he means. Sorry.
Very bad construction.
Yes. It's a disgusting hut. Yes. And disgust, it's used for disgusting things. Disgusting things happen there. Yes. A hovel, perhaps. But that's a mild word compared with this. Where he uses this word brothel somewhere. He doesn't? A harlot is a prostitute. A harlot is a prostitute. So, you know, this woman, this dreadful woman, she may rule like an empress, but it's in this dirty, disgusting hovel, nude, unashamed, but she still has this power of attraction, terrible attraction, and she exults in that. She delights in this. She lifts her evil face of perilous beauty and charm, and she this attraction is, there's also panic there. She brings forces to her embrace, and the effect of that embrace is to allure the spirits, fall to the shadow depths of life, the abyss of life.
She's on there, but still she's saying beauty also.
Perilous beauty, no? Perilous beauty.
He
said about these alluring lips and eyes, no? Armed with beauty like a snare. This kind of beauty is a trap.
He's talking about life, which is like that.
On the lower levels, life is like that. Irresistible, actually, but so terrible. I'm sorry, Tara, I didn't hear.
This line, he talks about the mother of evil.
The mother of evil, that's the title of the next canto.
Would you agree with that as a symbol?
Well, if that's what Sri Aurobindo says. Yes, yeah.
So she's asking about this particular line. Can it be called the mother of evil?
This life?
Yes, perhaps it can, Yes. But when he actually meets the mother of evil, it's even worse. Mm.
Mm.
Yes.
Why don't we meet the mother of evil with love? Why can't we love us for the children?
Yes, I think that's what happens. That's the key that he finds in the end of book 8. But we have to read it. We have to come there. I can't just say anything about it now.
Doesn't Kali have some relation to some of these things?
Well, it may appear like that to us, but Kali is divine and full of compassion. And whatever dreadful things she does out of love and for the good of the soul. So I think we shouldn't mix up Kali with this just because there are these similar descriptions. So in the next lines, it is she again. Puna, yes, please.
Across his field of sight, she multiplied as on a scenic film or movie play, the impeccable splendor of her nightmare form. On the dark background of a soulless world, she's caged between a lurid light and shade, her dramas of the sorrow of the deaths written on the agonized nerves of living things. Epics of horror and grim majesty rise, statues spat and stiffen in life's mud, a blur of hideous forms and hideous deeds.
Hideous forms.
And hideous deeds, paralyzed pity in the hardened breast. In boots of sin and night repairs of vice, piled infamies of the bodies on kutufun, and sordid imaginations ashed in flesh, turned lust into a decorative art, abusing nature's gift, her pervert skill, immortalized the soul grain of living death in a mud goblet cold the bracket.
Thank you. It's almost as if he's being forced to see all these dreadful things. Mm-hmm. But it's like watching a pornographic film or a drama. Asvapati is watching all this.
He's forced to see all this horror?
It seems like, yes. Yeah, he has to see it. Mm-hmm. But like a drama, no? He's not identified with it. He's the spectator watching all this. But he sees all these dreadful things and their effect. So the last two lines, in a mud goblet poured the Bacchic wine, to a satyr gave the thyrsus of a god. The Bacchic wine is actually the wine of divine intoxication. But here it's being offered in this... Not very good. A thyrsus is the wand that is the symbol of a god's power. So that wand, that thyrsus, which should be the power, represent a staff, yes, a staff or a wand. Anybody who has power has a kind of stick or wand or staff to represent his power. So that power, which represents the divinity of the god, is being given to a satyr, who is again a mythological beast, but it's an animal, and they're supposed to be a very lustful spirit, in the form of a goat. Mm. So it continues. Who's going to read?
Get this rise statue spat.
Mm. I think these are images. No. Of beings who are forced into these unnatural postures.
No, what part of speech is this spat?
From to spit.
No,
they are spitting.
It means these statues are made of life's mud.
Yes. Yeah. And they spit. They spit out their disgust.
I just kind of like that.
Right, they're twisted. Mm-hmm. First they spit, and then they stiffen into these terrible postures in life's mud. Mm-hmm. And there's so many of these hideous forms and hideous deeds, a glut, too many, far too many, so that you can't even feel pity any longer. Just too much of it. The breast, the responsive heart can't respond anymore. And then there are special places, booths of sin and night repairs of vice. All a repair is a place you go to. So, a night repair, it's again, it's a brothel. It's even a kind of art to show all these dreadful things, turn lust into a decorative art. So let's go on, let's go through this. Who's next, Danny?
Impure, sadistic, with the nice grimacing mouth, grave, full inventions, gruesome and macabre, came televisions from the doors of night. A craft, ingenious in monstrosity, impatient of all natural shame and poise, a gape of nude, exaggerated minds, gave caricature to stark reality, and art glares of weird distorted forms, and gargoyle masks obscene and terrible, trembled to tormented postures, the tall sand. An inexorable alien's worshipper, she made vileness great and sublimated filth, the braving power of entire energies, and strange epiphanies of governing force, and serpent wonders poaching the mire, to
a Let's pause there because there's many difficult words. No?
Have television been invented? Yes.
We think that Shobindo was writing this, and it's very significant that he was writing it at the end of the 30s.
He was for the same television?
Yes, maybe television had indeed been invented at that time, but probably he...
Around 1920, I think.
But probably he hadn't seen it. But he's using this word in the literal sense of television, seeing things at a distance. He's not... There's a kind of screen, and he's seeing all these terrible things.
Television sense in the sense that what sometimes they're showing.
Yes.
It's like from the hell.
Right. Yes. 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 Exactly. And it's these lines which suggest that he's being forced to see all this, no? This caricature, this perversion, these art parades of weird, distorted forms, gargoyle masks. Mask in the sense of a dance which tells a story, and the characters are often disguised and wear masks. Those are gargoyle masks. You know what a gargoyle is? On the European cathedrals, they have these water spouts to take the water, or sometimes on a column. In Gothic architecture, yeah. The artists have carved weird, distorted figures. Some of them are just wonderful, but still they're somehow unnatural and can be frightening. No? He says they're obscene and terrible, and that it is actually a torture to the senses to see them.
Some of the art of 20th century is like that.
Some of it is like that, yes.
It reminds me of the portrait of Dorian Gray.
Yes. Yeah.
And the horror of his appearance gradually became more and more.
Yes. He goes on looking beautiful and young, but his portrait reflects all the terrible deeds that he's done. Terrible.
Do you think he wrote that before the television was invented?
We were just talking about that, Patty. television had probably been invented, but probably Shobindo hadn't seen it, but he must have known about the principle of it. But regardless of whether he had or he hadn't, he's using that word here in its literal sense of things being projected from a distance.
Telling means seeing something, doing at a distance, like telephone, something.
We have a telescope.
And the thyrsus, did you say that? I missed that one.
Yes. A thyrsus is like the stick or staff or wand which an enchanter has to show his power.
Right, okay.
I think originally thyrsus is a plant. It's a tree.
Would you look it up? Could you find out?
Yeah, I think that the original word is a tree. And then you use this...
So that the stick, yes. Yeah. But it's interesting to think that all these people who have powers of one kind or another, they always have some stick or wand or something that they use to command all the powers who are underneath them. Yes, that's what it is.
And he's even giving a good example of television, like Sanjay predicted everything for the thrust of Mahabharata.
Yes.
Sanjay was seeing.
Oh, exactly, yes. In the, with the Mahabharata, when there's the battle on Kurukshetra, Sanjaya, the Dhritarashtra, the king's charioteer, I think he is, no? As his close servant, is given the power to see everything that's happening on the battlefield. So the blind king hears, he's given a detailed account of everything that's happening. Thank you. So this is the picture of the mother of evil, perhaps we can say, as an inexorable worshipper of evil. No, she's worshipping evil and she won't give up. She makes vileness great and sublimated filth. The idea of sublimation is lifting something up to a height. She's a dragon power of reptile energies. These reptiles that crawl in the mud. And strange epiphanies of groveling force. An epiphany is actually a revelation of divinity. Epiphany, it's like darshan, no? Seeing the divine. These are strange epiphanies of force that's groveling in the mud. This draws adoration and worship to something that's actually only a gleam of slime, dirty, decaying matter which gives off some kind of biophosphorescence.
And she even though uses serpent only for negative forces, or sometimes she's always that.
What word?
Evil for serpent forces.
No, serpent forces, they can be. They can be either way. They are forces. Yeah. They're not always negative.
Chinese are like, it's very. Yeah. Chinese serpents are dragons.
Yes, it's very interesting, this difference between East and West, that in the East, dragons are benevolent and helpful creatures.
In India, only the king cobra, otherwise,
It's also a serpent power, no? Yes. And they can give great gifts also. And the thing about a dragon, whether they're eastern dragons or western dragons, is that they collect treasure. They collect jewels and gold and they sit on it. They like to sit on it. They're not usually very willing to part with what they're sitting on.
Even the eastern oriental dragon?
They don't normally give you their jewels. They might, perhaps. But they bring the rain, they bring the heavenly energies.
The Emperor of China was represented by a five-fingered dragon.
Yeah, because he's a great ruler, a power man, with a possessor of great witches, no? Sitting on it.
The ashram there is a third of this dragons from the mother that she appreciated very much, the golden.
She had brought somehow, I think whether it was from China or from Japan, she had this curtain with her, and on 24th of November 1926, with the Sri Aurobindo Siddhi Day, that was somehow how she announced it. This curtain was hung and Sri Aurobindo sat in front of it, and each of these dragons has a meaning. These are the three worlds, I think, no? The higher, the mid world, and the lower world joined.
The dragon also in Oriental temples, the fountain.
Yes,
dragon's
mouth. Yes, they bring water, and water represents divine energy, life energy. So let's not get too tangled up in that. It's actually time to stop for today.
Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.